mottled and discolored skin, the uneven flesh. I guess now that I'm here, I feel like I've been heading this way for a long time without knowing it. And that was all true. It wasn't the whole story, but she hoped that it was enough to convince him that he couldn't talk her out of going. "Wait here," the man said after a long moment. He stood up and went out the door, closing it hard behind him. She wondered if that was her psych evaluation. She'd heard something about one, about how you had to be sane enough to be able to say where you were going and why for the authorities to let you into a cold town. Back in the old days, you had to have a driver's license. Suspended was okay. Or a state-issued ID card saying you were over 16. But not anymore. They made it easier and easier to give up your life so your neighbors could have the illusion of safety. Tana sat in the little room, looked at her phone, and watched the minutes tick closer to dawn. When the door opened, the gray-haired clerk from the front office was behind it. "You carrying any contraband?" she asked, entering the room and patting Tana down the way airport security did if you set off the metal detector. Tana wasn't sure what the clerk would consider forbidden, but she wasn't carrying much of anything. She shook her head. After a moment, the clerk nodded and handed her a small manila envelope with a band around it. "There's your marker, and the paperwork that says you got the exclusive bounty on one vampire." The clerk turned and motioned for Tana to follow her. "Also, your deregistration materials. Got it?" "So if I want to leave Cold Town, I just come back to the gates and present the marker?" The clerk took a long look at Tana. "You're never getting out, honey, so don't you worry about it." That so unnerved her that she didn't say anything else as they walked together down a short hallway. The clerk touched her key card to a plate near the door and it swung open. Midnight was there, leaning against the wall of another hallway, the straining garbage bag slung over her shoulder and a beat-up suitcase at her feet. Her blue hair was pushed back from her face, a streak of dye marking her ears. The skin around her eyes looked red and a little puffy, as though maybe she'd been crying. "Both of you, go on through that door," the woman said. "On the other side, there's a camera halfway up the wall. Take turns looking up into it. It's a retinal scanning device." They did. The camera was only a small lens threaded through the concrete block walls. Tana stared up at it for a long moment until it flashed with a flare of light. Then she walked deeper into the room. Once Midnight stepped in behind her, the door shut with a whooshing sound and then a metallic click. Airtight, Tana guessed. It had no knob or other means of opening from this side, not even a plate for a key card. She studied the room, noting the reinforced door frames and what she guessed was shatterproof glass set in the small windows at their centers. Unlike the run-down front office, this was serious business. For a moment, Tana wondered if the reason the clerk predicted she wouldn't make it out was that a dozen darts were about to shoot from the walls and kill her. But then there was another single, heavy click along the far wall, and the clerk's voice floated down through hidden speakers. "Please exit through the opposite door, which is now unlocked. You will be walking into a containment chamber inside the quarantine sector. Once you're outside, wait for me to lower you down and unlock the gate. Then you will have 3 minutes to enter the city. If you do not enter the city willingly during the 3-minute grace period, your entry will be accomplished by force." "Don't worry," Midnight yelled. "We can't wait to get the hell out of here." Tana snorted and they shared an exhausted smile. Then she stepped up to the door on the opposite side and pushed. But at her touch, the door opened onto a cage suspended high above Cold Town. For a moment, Tana just looked out in amazement. An open cell was in front of her, rocking gently back and forth, thick black bars on all sides but one, where it was attached to the wall with chains. Midnight stepped past her onto the platform, dumping her stuff on the floor and sinking down next to it. "Come on," Midnight said. "Are you afraid of heights?"
"I am now."
Tana took a deep breath and launched herself onto the platform. It swung a little unsteadily, causing Midnight to grab for the bars and look at Tana with wide eyes. Ignoring midnight, she tried her best not to look over the side. They were at least 4 or 5 stories up, and she could see the tops of several buildings from their odd, birdcage-like perch. Smoke rose in a few gray ribbons, and multicolored lights pulsed inside what looked to have once been a church. It was a fallen landscape, a magnificent ruination of a city. Overhead, the sky was already lightening, the pale blue and gold of morning tinting the eastern portion, although bright stars still burned in the west. Dawn was coming fast. To the right-hand side, in the back of the gate, bodies were being laid out in a single tidy row. 5 rested there, most wound in stained sheets. 2 boys were dragging a 6th body, spread out on a plastic tarp, into a place at the end. One of the boys looked up at them, but Tana couldn't read his expression from so far away. With the sound of metal grating against metal, the cage began to slide abruptly downward. Tana's stomach lurched. Midnight made a small cry of surprise. As they came away from the wall, the door fell from the top, closing with a rusty clang. The cage was something she'd never seen before, not in any of the photos from Cold Town. It felt like something from another time. "This is crazy," Tana said dizzily. Midnight looked a little awed herself. "It's because they don't want any doors on the wall to open right onto the city." The streets below seemed mostly abandoned, although a few stragglers had stopped to watch their descent from a distance. Tana looked out at the city. She felt as though she had stumbled into a world alien and yet familiar. She'd seen it on the news, seen it in the background of the vids of runaways and in the photographs of daring journalists. She had seen the blackened, burned remains of old buildings captured in pictures, seen what had once been a row of storefronts, now with spiderweb shatters in the glass, with blankets and plastic bags covering the empty frames of windows, and the jagged outlines of edifices stretching out toward the far walls. Spires whose panes flickered with light, great domed buildings pulsing with distant music. A landscape gone feral. "Hey," Midnight said, pointing down the side of the wall. "Look, the boys." Tana turned slowly, trying not to make the thing sway more than it was. Aiden, Winter, and Gabriel were in another cage suspended beneath theirs, one that swung in a pendulum-like motion but went no lower. Gabriel stood with his fingers through the bars, looking out at the orange haze in the east with a smile lifting one corner of his mouth. Winter stood next to him, with Aiden on the floor, his feet dangling through the bars. "I think ours is broken," Aiden called up to them. "They mess with vampires like that, I heard," said Midnight softly, nodding to the wall. "They'll wait as long as they can." In the dim light, Tana saw scorch marks along the cinder block exterior, ones that seemed to have flared up as if something had been very close to it while burning.
"You've got to get out of there," Tana called. "I really think—"
Gabriel tore the gate off the hinges. Midnight screamed at the suddenness of it. One moment, the vampire had been looking out at the sky, and the next, he had peeled back the metal with his hands. Now Tana looked at the warped remains of the hinges, pulled like taffy, and then at Gabriel's face, transformed by whatever power let him do that. His mouth gaped open, fangs evident. When he looked up at her, hunger twisted his features, and she was suddenly glad to be far from him. He jumped down to the dirt below, landing as easily as a cat. A few moments later, the cage that held Tana and Midnight hit the ground too, knocking Tana to her knees. There was a loud buzzing and their door opened. Midnight staggered out, pulling her garbage bag behind her as her brother lowered himself on a loose piece of chain. They stumbled through a section of road that was probably once a roundabout, but was now an asphalt courtyard, an island of overgrown shrubs and weeds at its center. Aiden followed them, falling clumsily. He got up and brushed himself off, looking back at the wall with horror, as though the reality of their situation had just settled over him.
"Quick," Midnight said, pulling her brother to his feet. "Come on, we've got to get out of here." Where are we going? Aiden called as he ran. He reached for Tana's hand. She took it, and they raced after midnight in winter. The streets had been paved a long time ago, but they were cracked now, with deep pits. Tana had to watch each step as she moved, fast as she dared, skipping after Aiden. She looked back once to see that Gabriel was still with them, his face blank. He must be very, very hungry, she thought. Very, very, very hungry. From the windows of houses, from behind drapes and blinds and shutters, they were being watched. Watched as they stumbled past mounds of refuse, past rats that scattered at their approach and gleaming black flies that rose like an oily mist off rotting food in the long dead body of a dog. They turned onto a narrow street, winter and midnight dragging their garbage bags and suitcase, looking shaken. Halfway down the block, Midnight leaned over and braced her hands on her thighs, breathing hard. Her hair hung down, the shadows turning it dark. We have to figure out where we are, she said. Dawn's coming, said Tana, letting go of Aiden. She was winded, too, and leaned against the brick wall. The building opposite it was covered in graffiti, elaborate paintings of dragons, of which she could only make out a few details in the gloom. Midnight knelt down and unzipped her case. Just give me a minute. I downloaded a bunch of different sketches kids uploaded of the streets. They're the only maps we've got.
It wasn't supposed to be like this, Winter said tonelessly.
He wasn't talking to them, Tana could tell. Maybe he wasn't talking to anybody. Gabriel moved beside Tana. In the dark, she couldn't see him very well. He just looked like a pretty boy, tall and lanky. She thought again of the crumpled paper in her purse and of him, caged beneath a cemetery. How long had he been there? How long had he looked just as he did now? 100 years? 200? Could he even remember the press of time? Maybe having stepped outside of it would drive anybody crazy. I must go, Gabriel said, pushing back ash-black hair and looking at her with the utter sincerity of the drunk or deranged.
You will take care, won't you? The city is hungry.
You're going now? Tana asked him. She should have been relieved, knowing what he was and what he was capable of, but she didn't want him to go. The thought of being alone with Aiden and Midnight and Winter filled her with a nameless anxiety. It's almost dawn. You don't even know where you're going. He smiled, a real smile, the kind real boys gave real girls.
It's been a very long time since anyone worried for me.
Ahead of them, Midnight was looking at her tablet. Its glow lit her face from beneath, as though she were going to tell a ghost story. They have a friend, Tana began.
I have a friend, too, said Gabriel. And I mean to kill him.
Oh, Tana took a step back. He was on the run, the same as before, even if the reasons were different. She thought of the vampires at Lance's sundown party, who were doubtless planning to drag him back to the Père Lachaise Cemetery, where they'd torture him until he got even crazier than he was now, until his mind was so lost that he could no longer hold on to it even some of the time. He'd broken out once, but she doubted he could do it again. She made her voice as firm as possible. Don't let them catch you. He hesitated, clearly surprised by her words. Then he smiled again, inclining his head in a shallow bow, acknowledging everything she'd left unsaid.
Traveling with you was a delight worth any delay, but I can delay no longer.
Midnight straightened up. Okay, I figured out where we have to go. It's not far. She slung her garbage bag back over her shoulder and began to march down the alley. Come on, she said, looking back at Tana and Gabriel. Aiden followed closely with a worried look at the sky.
Is he going to be...
Tana, Winter called. We're moving. Remember what you told me in the car, she said to Gabriel.
Death's favorites don't die.
I am no favorite.
As he said the words, his expression changed. His fingers closed on her shoulder.
His eyes glittered like gems as he bent toward her.
But let me have one last thing I do not deserve.
For a moment, she shrank back automatically, thinking he was going to bite her. Then, stunned, she realized that that wasn't what he intended to do at all. His lips brushed hers lightly, as though he was giving her the chance to push him away. She squeezed her eyes shut to blot out the terrible thing she was about to do and pulled him closer. She wasn't supposed to want this. When he kissed her again, she gasped against his cold mouth. Her breath held too long since he didn't need to breathe at all. Her tongue sliding against his, brushing against sharp teeth. He was careful, but she still felt the drag of their points against her lower lip. The cool press of his body made her skin feel fevered. He pulled away from her and touched his mouth, his face full of a gentle amazement.
I didn't remember it was like that.
Tana's heartbeat seemed to have moved into her whole body and thrilled it with a single speeding pulse. Everything was a little blurred at the edges, and she wanted him to feel like she did, like he'd done something forbidden, wanted to give him something he'd like and really wasn't supposed to have, something that would feel wrong, something he wanted. Kiss me again, she whispered, reaching up, her fingers sliding through his hair. She almost didn't know herself as she moved against him. He bent helplessly toward her. She bit her tongue, bit it hard, the pain chasing through her nerve endings and alchemizing into something close to pleasure. When her mouth opened under his, it was flooded with welling blood. He groaned at the taste of it, red eyes going wide with surprise and something like fear. His hands gripped her arms as he pushed her body back against the brick of the wall, holding her in place. He'd been careful before, but he wasn't being careful now as he licked her mouth, and it amazed her as much as it terrified her. He kissed her ferociously, savagely, their lips sliding together with bruising fervor. The pain in her tongue became a distant throbbing. Her fingers dug into the muscles of his back, their bodies pressed so close that he must have felt every hitch in her breath, every shuddering beat of her heart. And as scared of him as she had been, right then, she was more frightened of herself. Gabriel reeled back from her, lips ruddy. He wiped his mouth against the back of his hand, her blood smearing over his skin. Gazing at her for a long moment with something like horror, as though he was seeing her for the first time, he spoke.
You are more dangerous than daybreak.
Before Tana could reply, he stepped into the lengthening shadows of morning and was gone. Chapter 18. I want to be all used up when I die. George Bernard Shaw. When Gabriel was young, Russia was nearing the end of her golden age. Revolution was coming, but the aristocracy pretended otherwise, swilling champagne and speaking in perfectly accented French in their gilt parlors. The books of the day gloried in the nobility of suicide, willful decay and romantic melancholy. At 20, Gabriel, called Gavril then, had inherited his grandfather's voluptuous mouth and flashing eyes, but he didn't seem to be living down to that inheritance. He was the middle child, with a little sister called Katya, sparkling and sharp as a diamond in the imperial crown, and an older brother named Alexander, who was constantly in debt to decadence. Alexander was a drunk, a gambler, and a womanizer, each a costly habit on its own. Combined, they threatened to bankrupt the family. Their father, the Vicomte, was 3 years in the grave when their mother begged Gabriel to talk with his brother and coax him to be more reasonable in his debauches. But it was impossible to convince Alexander of anything that inconvenienced him now that he'd inherited the title and all the land that came with it.
You are the good brother, Alexander would say. There need be only one of those in a family, don't you think? Two is indecent.
I will switch places with you if you like, Sasha, said Gabriel. Your responsibility is a younger son's portion.
Alexander would hear none of it. And, in truth, Gabriel was too distracted to make much argument. He had fallen in love with a girl named Rosa, met through a friend's sister. Rosa had amber eyes and a mass of hair, the dark blonde of buckwheat honey. When she'd glanced shyly in his direction that first time, a half-smile on her mouth, he found that he could barely catch his breath. Later, he couldn't quite remember what they'd spoken of, only that he'd been desperate to charm her. Incredibly, he seemed to have succeeded. She agreed to let him pay court to her. Her father, the stolid owner of a factory, had more than one daughter to settle, and seemed to find Gabriel's title and connections enough to make up for the paucity of his finances. Love took Gabriel as nothing had before. He was drunk with it. He wrote Rosa long letters in which he shamelessly stole lines from Tutchev to describe her eyes. He cajoled his mother into letting him give her a sapphire ring that could have been sold instead. He took a new interest in his clothes, suddenly aware of every worn cuff and hem on his coats. The longer it went on, the less Alexander found it amusing. "You're making a fool of yourself over a merchant's daughter," he would say, before Gabriel stalked from the table. "It's one thing to marry her for her money, but you do her too much honor by this display." Maybe that was what prompted Alexander. Perhaps he wanted his responsible, careful, dull younger brother back. Or maybe he merely thought that since Gabriel couldn't see what a fool he was making of himself, Alexander would make a bigger fool of him, big enough to make him see. Whatever the reason, Alexander set out to and succeeded in seducing and debauching Rosa. She wept as she explained, sitting on a silk-covered couch and begging Gabriel not to be angry, that she and his brother had never meant to fall in love. Gabriel sat stock still. Inside him roiled such turmoil that he feared that should he move, he would smash every piece of furniture in the room, crack every pane of every window, until there was nothing but shining splinters where the parlor had been. Instead, he leaned back his head and laughed, a long, cruel laugh that did not seem to belong to the boy Rosa had known. It blazed up from deep inside him, from some embers he'd always been careful never to stoke. "You're a fool," he told her, and watched her stumble out of the drawing room, looking back at him as if he were the betrayer. She'd go to him now, Gabriel reasoned. For long moments he sat, staring at the wall, willing himself to calm. Finally, he got up, intending to leave the house. On the way through the hall, he passed the library, where Rosa was kneeling on the floor, massive skirts billowing around her, hands over her face. Alec was heaping scorn on her, telling her he would never marry a girl who'd already proved herself faithless. She'd misunderstood. He'd promised her nothing. He merely wanted to know what kind of wife his brother would choose for himself. It was a terrible thing, the glee with which Alexander dismantled every one of her romantic hopes. He had ruined her, and he was proud of it. Gabriel waited until she staggered out, racking sobs threatening to rob her of the ability to walk, before he challenged his brother to a duel. His voice was unsteady when he spoke the words. Alexander looked at him as if he were a puppy trying to show his teeth. Then Alec walked to a crystal decanter, pouring out a measure of clear liquid. "Don't be ridiculous." Gabriel knocked his brother's glass to the floor, shattering it. Then, taking a step towards Alexander, Gabriel slapped him across his cheek, the sound of skin against skin as sharp as a branch snapped in two. For a moment, Alec staggered back. Then, throwing his hands up in resignation, Alexander agreed to meet Gabriel on the grounds of their estate the following morning, an hour before dawn. He didn't seem particularly concerned, touching his reddened cheek with a grin. He'd been in 13 duels before, and had emerged without so much as a scratch. He was an excellent shot. Gabriel had been Alexander's second, but he had never done anything more than stand around on the grass and make sure the pistols were properly ready. One of the servants must have overheard and told the Vicontess, because she came to Gabriel's room that night and begged him not to go. When he refused, she said she would go to Alexander and persuade him to apologize for the grave offense.
"I will not forgive him," Gabriel told her, "and I still mean to marry her. Do you understand?"
"Rosa?" his mother asked, her voice shaking. "You cannot."
"Even if I no longer loved her, I would marry her to prove that he cannot take from me what I will not give. I would do it despite him, but I do love her."
His mother laughed, wringing her hands. The sun was already rising, orange flames licking the sky, when Alexander arrived at the clearing where the duel was set to take place. He was stumbling drunk. Two of his friends held him up. They found Gabriel alone, pacing through the snow, the shoulders of his long coat dusted with fresh flakes.
"Ganya!"
Alexander cried out, as though nothing could please him more than the sight of his little brother.
"Have you been waiting long?"
Gabriel shook his head. "Not long at all."
"You can't go through with this,"
said a boy named Vladimir, one of his arms around Alexander, staggering under his weight.
"Go to the devil,"
Alexander said, pulling out of their hold. He drew his own pistol and lurched over the snow, getting closer to Gabriel, waving the gun around.
"My little brother wants to defend his honor. Let him. I thought he was too much of a coward. Come on, Ganya, shoot! What are you waiting for?"
"Sasha can barely stand," Vladimir called.
"Don't be stupid!"
It was just like Alexander to steal even this from him, Gabriel thought. To treat the duel as a joke. To treat him as a joke. Now his only choices were to take aim at a man about to fall over, or to bear the shame of crying off. And Alexander would laugh at him later.
"I wasn't so very drunk," he would say.
"And if I was, so what? If you weren't such a milksop, then surely you'd have..."
Gabriel raised his pistol and shot his brother through the heart. For a long moment, there was only the burn of the gun in his hand, and Alexander's blood staining the snow like spilled rubies. No one spoke. Then Gabriel threw down the gun and began walking back to the house. He felt as cold as the snow. By evening, Rosa had heard of Alexander's death. Mad with grief, she threw herself into an icy river and drowned. Gabriel's mother, having lost one son, refused to lose another. She gave Gabriel what jewels hadn't already been sold and sent him to Paris, where the Russian authorities couldn't arrest him. There, in Paris, he fulfilled the promise of his voluptuous mouth and passionate eyes. He fulfilled the promise of his blood. If his brother was bad, he was determined to be worse. He drank absinthe to his brother's wine. He gambled away the boots right off his feet. And if Alexander had been a rake, Gabriel was determined to best him by never saying no, not even to the crudest, most degrading, and vile offers, not to anything. That was when he met Lucian. Chapter 19. You crave one kiss of my clay-cold lips, but my breath smells earthy strong. If you have one kiss of my clay-cold lips, your time will not be long. The Child Ballads, 78. The Unquiet Grave. Eyebrows raised, lips caught in mid-scoff, Aiden was watching Tana from the mouth of the alley. Midnight smirked, looking into her phone and thumbing something on the screen, while Winter glowered impatiently beside her. The wind caught Midnight's and Winter's hair, which blew like two blazes of deep blue sky.
"Well, that was interesting," Winter said, sour-voiced.
Tana rubbed her hand against her face, her thoughts too chaotic to make any sense. All she knew was that she was embarrassed. Her face felt hot and her tongue stung, reminding her of what she'd been doing. "You waited,"
Aiden took a step toward her, the smile leaving his face.
Hey, you okay? He didn't hurt you, did he?
To get that reaction, her expression must be very strange, Tana realized. Midnight rolled her eyes, as though Aiden was being ridiculous.
I bet you were a good girl back home, she said to Tana. A good girl all your life until you finally met the trouble you want to get in.
You obviously don't know her at all, Aiden told Midnight gruffly. Then he turned back to Tana.
Did he bite you?
She shook her head. The more she thought about it, the more stupid she felt. She was probably infected, but that didn't mean she should have tempted him into making it a sure thing. And, hungry as he was, crazy as he might be, he could have drained her dead, pinned her against the brick wall, and ripped out her throat. She'd been playing with fire, just as he'd accused Midnight of doing.
Clever girl. You play with fire because you want to be burnt.
At that thought, a feeling of vast exhaustion came over her. They'd made it beyond the gates of Coldtown, and Tana was tempted to lie down amid the refuse, close her heavy eyes, and pretend away everything else. She'd done her best to protect the world from what she and Aiden would become, and now that that was done, despair settled on her shoulders. She didn't want to be infected. She didn't want to think about the taste of her own blood, or about how, if she sucked hard enough on her own tongue, the taste would bloom fresh in her mouth. She rubbed the scar on her arm and thought about what it must feel like to press teeth against skin, about what her mother must have had to do to rip open an arm. She stopped herself in the unconscious act of bringing her own wrist to her lips. Winter sighed and took her by the elbow, steering her down the street.
You sure he didn't bite you? You're acting weird.
I'm fine. I just didn't think, you know, she said finally, stumbling along the cracked concrete sidewalk behind him and smiling a little guiltily. I didn't think they could even like that sort of thing. Winter's lip curled at the edge.
You sure looked as though you...
Okay, okay. She lifted her hands, interrupting him, warding off the words. She remembered looking at Gabriel's mouth, smeared with Aiden's blood when he got into the driver's side of the car back at the gas station. She'd thought about kissing him then, sure. But it was one of those messed-up fantasies that people have when they're under stress. Sick, but harmless. It wasn't like he was ever going to know.
Haven't you watched the feeds? Winter asked her, more gently. Vampires like anything and everything that keeps them from getting bored. Anything and everything.
She shook her head again, shaking off the conversation in a motion that turned into a shudder.
I've got pictures of you two lovebirds, said Midnight in a sing-song voice, holding out her phone.
They weren't clear, just images of two dark shapes leaned against each other, the outline of cheekbones and his fingers in her hair, the glare from a window above them that had probably messed up the camera's light sensors.
You should probably just delete those, Tana said, embarrassed, reaching for the phone. You can barely see anything.
Oh, no, I don't think so,
Midnight laughed, dancing out of Tana's way, clearly pleased that her teasing had some effect.
While you were busy saying goodbye, I found us a place that's not too far. My friend Rufus has a squat over on one of the renamed streets, Wormwood.
Tana nodded, trying to smile. What she needed was sleep, she decided. Lots and lots of sleep.
Lead on, Aiden said.
His skin had an odd sheen to it, and he looked pale, as though his blood was cooling inside him, as though body warmth would soon be something that could only be stolen from others. A few cars were parked on the sidewalk. One sheltered a woman bundled up in a comforter in the back seat, among bags of garbage. Was she alive? Tana couldn't see the blanket rise or fall. Another car burned merrily, sending acrid black smoke up into the sky. Tana passed two girls holding each other up, clearly coming from a party. One had green glitter sparkling in her hair, and the other was wearing the torn remains of a gold sequin dress. They were barefoot, seeming to have lost their shoes. Both had bruises and needle marks all the way up their calves to their thighs, disappearing beneath the hems of their dresses. Both had identical expressions of dazed contentment as they staggered along. A few blocks away, someone began to scream. A moment later, that scream was joined by another and another. Three voices, each distinct, each rising and falling in a continuous cry that made up a hellish melody. The barefoot girl stumbled, looked in the direction of the sound, and then kept on walking, one speaking softly to the other. Midnight bit her lower lip, sucking the ball of a silvery ring into her mouth. She shook her head. Aiden closed his eyes, seeming to drink in the sound. "Come on," Tana said, turning down a garbage-strewn alley, heading in the direction of the screams before she thought better of it. "This is exactly what's wrong with me," she told herself as she walked. "If there's trouble, I go straight for it." "Are you sure?" Winter asked, but followed her anyway. Several blocks later, they came to a crossroads with a large courtyard. A crowd of humans had gathered around the edges, some of the people carrying white flowers. Three vampires knelt at the very center of the road, underneath a defunct stoplight. A man, a woman, and a young girl, screeching up at the sky as the sunlight scorched them. Their hair flamed. Flesh was blackening and flaking off, like paint from the planks of an old house. Underneath, their skin looked raw and red, as though they were made of embers instead of muscles and ligaments. In moments, their cries had grown guttural, and then the noise diminished. Two people from the crowd inched closer to the bodies, and the woman vampire jerked upright. Tana saw a flash of fangs before the vampire collapsed again in a heap of black smoke and steam. Gasps rose from the crowd, and a few people stepped farther away. "I know what this place is," Winter said under his breath. "Suicide Square." For a moment, Tana was sure she hadn't heard him right. She felt dizzy with horror. "If you've seen videos of vampires burning in the sun on YouTube, this is where most of the footage comes from." He pointed up at a camera mounted outside a window. Then he nodded to the audience. "People come out to watch them die. Happens every morning. Citizens hope to get infected or for the vampire to give out money or information. Sometimes they can be generous right before they die, I hear. Or other times they'll kill a bunch of the crowd just for spite." "But why do they want to die?" Tana asked. Midnight looked at the dying vampires. Her lip curled with contempt. "Most of them never wanted to go cold in the first place. They can't hack drinking blood or being stuck in Cold Town. A lot of them can't deal with the things they did when they were freshly turned. Not everyone's worthy." "Not everyone's a monster," Tana thought. It should have made her feel better, more proof that vampires weren't so inhuman that they didn't feel pity or fear or regret. Instead, it just reminded her that sometimes there were no good choices. "Or they get super bored," Winter said. "That's why the old ones die. Eventually, they don't care enough to feed and they starve." Midnight gave him an unfriendly look and he stopped talking. She drew herself up, and Tana could see her willing him to remember his role. They had an image to project, two beautiful, condescending creatures who needed nothing but each other, who walked in each other's shadows automatically. But Tana could tell that Midnight didn't like Winter's talking about some future, or even if they were vampires, they still might not be happy. "You can ask Lucien Moreau about it personally," Midnight said, as though reminding her brother of something he should already know. "We're going to crash one of his parties." Aiden had moved into the shadows of a building, as if the sun bothered him. Tana wondered if he was trying to imagine himself as one of them, wondering if he could hack it, wondering if he was worthy. "But why die like this?" Tana asked softly to herself, not really expecting an answer. Two of the vampires had stopped moving, but the little girl, now almost entirely cinders, moved occasionally, spasmodically, causing what was left of her to crumble. People had begun to throw the white blossoms, pelting flowers at the girl in particular.
Tradition? Winter shrugged, turning away from the spectacle. He was trying to play it off as if he were apathetic about what was happening, but he looked pale and sick. Watching the vampires burn up in front of him wasn't like watching it on video. It was different to hear their screams echoing across the square. It was different when, with every breath, you sucked in the smell of scorched skin and hair.
Now at least we know where we are in the map, Midnight said.
There was a light in her face that Tana hadn't seen before, a beatific calm, as though, perhaps for the first time, she felt sure about everything.
It should be easy to find Rufus's place.
Tana took Aiden's arm, lacing her fingers through his, ignoring how cold they felt. His gaze seemed to snag on people from the crowd and follow them for a bit, before moving to study another, a cheetah surveying a herd of gazelles for stragglers. They marched a few more blocks in the dawn light, Winter and Midnight in the lead, looking for the right street. Some had regular names like Orange or Dickinson or Mill Road, but others had new names, scrawled along the fronts of buildings or pasted over the original signs, proclaiming them Way of the Dragon or The Nonsense Court of Endless Alley or Butcher's Boulevard. The confusion was made worse by house marks that were even stranger. Some numbered in random order, others in hammered cuneiform, or even random letters of the alphabet. There was a series of houses scrawled with what seemed to be a combination of stick figure drawings and mathematical code. The area they walked through mostly consisted of row houses, a few brick industrial buildings, and the odd church, one with its stained glass windows smashed and its door spray painted with the word Rotters in bright neon green. The streets were quiet, but somehow Tana thought she saw someone watching them from a window. They passed a brown lawn with what looked like a body collapsed in a wilted bush. The reek of it, a heady mix of decay and spilled wine, persuaded her to stay back and to pull Aiden's arm, hard, when he started over.
"The hunger's bad," he said, clawing at my stomach. "For a while I was okay, but I don't think I'm going to be okay for much longer."
She nodded. She wasn't sure how long she was going to be okay for either. As they walked on, she noticed a dark-haired boy watching her from the vantage of a peaked roof. He was shirtless, his brown arms covered almost entirely in colorful tattoos. An albino crow sat on his arm, its snowy head and bone-pale beak tipped to one side. Even from the street, she could see the glint of the creature's pink eyes.
"Hey," Winter said. "There. That's the house."
Tana turned to observe Midnight walking toward a set of steps, her garbage bag luggage resting by the side of the street. The place was 3 stories in height, with what looked like a rotted-out balcony on the 3rd floor. The sides had been painted a deep gray, but had chipped and bubbled off to reveal pale blue underneath. There was very little lawn out front, and what grass grew there was scrubby and brownish. Tana glanced back toward the roof on the other side of the street, but the boy with the crow was gone.
"Do they know about us?" she asked, hesitating on the stairs. "Me and Aiden? We're not exactly safe to be around."
Midnight narrowed her eyes at Tana, then knocked her fist against the wood frame.
"That's not going to be a problem," she said over her shoulder.
Then the door opened a crack, a chain keeping it from opening farther. Midnight said something. The door shut, and then, latch removed, swung open wide. A boy was standing in the doorway, looking like a pirate or a prince. Half his head was shaved, and he wore layered clothing of leather and flowing cotton, with rings on each of his fingers and long necklaces of silver and bone hanging one over another at his throat. He waved them inside with a grand sweep of his bejeweled hand. Tana followed the others into a house that had long ago fallen into disrepair. Mildew discolored the ceiling, and flickering candles cast strange shadows on the smoke-stained walls of the curtained room. A tall girl with honey-blonde hair wearing a vintage pale pink gown, almost the color of her flesh, sat on an old Victorian settee with the stuffing hanging out. Next to her, on a threadbare divan, was a dark-skinned girl, her hair dyed bright red and twisted up with a stick, wearing black jeans and an army coat. The room was coated in a perfume of herbs and alcohol, so raw that it scorched Tana's nose to breathe. Against one wall, cans were stacked up next to cardboard boxes. She could read them from where she was: peaches and syrup, peas and carrots, corned beef hash.
"This is my friend Rufus, the one I was telling you about," Midnight said, seeming thoroughly delighted, touching the shoulder of the boy with the half-shaved head. He smiled at her.
"Welcome, everyone," Rufus said. "Get comfortable."
Midnight walked over to the couch and reclined on it like an evil queen. She reached out a slippered foot to slide it up the tall girl's knee and then pointed her toe toward the other.
"This is Christabel and Zara. Zara and Christabel, meet Tana and Aiden."
Aiden grinned at the girls but stayed near the door. Winter went back outside to bring in the rest of their stuff. He dragged in Midnight's garbage bag and dumped it on the floor heavily beside his, and then set down their suitcase beside the bags.
"Thanks for putting us up," Tana said warily.
"Is this house yours?" Aiden asked.
Very deliberately, he walked to the stairs and sat down on them, clenching his hands into fists.
"It's ours now," said Christabel. "There's plenty of abandoned places. You just pick one out and break in."
"Bill Story lives next door," said Zara, hunching forward. "He's been streaming feeds since the city was quarantined."
"I've always wanted to meet him," Midnight said dreamily. "The intrepid reporter."
Even Tana had heard of William T. Willingham, a comic book writer who'd been caught behind the gates, given up fiction, picked a catchy name, and turned to documentary-style reporting about what was really happening inside the quarantine. His literary friends tried to get him out, but he gave the two markers they'd sent away, one right after the other, to people he said were more deserving and who had no chance otherwise of being released. Cynics claimed he'd never been as famous as he was in Coldtown and was going to milk it for all it was worth. According to them, he was shopping an autobiography. Fans said he was the perfect example of how brave regular people could really be when life turned out differently than expected. Tana had seen footage of him once, a regular-looking guy in glasses.
"I can never decide if I'm lucky or not to have seen this," he'd said.
Tana thought about the marker in her purse and couldn't imagine giving up her only chance to get out. Not for anything. She wondered how long Rufus and Christabel and Zara had been in Coldtown, breaking into houses, posting about their adventures, and not worrying about the future. She wondered if there was something about the city that made you want to stay, despite everything. Of course, since most people were stuck here, it didn't matter whether they wanted to stay or not. She thought of Pauline, sleeping in her bunk at drama camp. Was she up yet? Eventually, someone from back home would call her to tell her what happened. Or she'd go online and see pictures, read reports. Then she'd realize that Tana had called her after the massacre, called her and lied. For a moment, the weight of everything that had happened in the last day settled on Tana's shoulders. Winter crossed the room and sat down on the floor beside Midnight, resting his head on her knee. They looked like a match set of elegant punk rock figurines.
"You're both just like I thought you'd be," said Rufus, eyeing them appreciatively.
"Just like in your videos. You're not scared at all, even in the middle of this place, are you?"
Midnight shook her head, posing deliberately.
"I feel like after a long journey, we've finally come home."
The others giggled, but Tana could tell they were impressed by her. Christabel looked over at Tana and patted the seat beside her.
"You look so tired. Come in, sit down. You're safe here."
Tana crossed the floor and perched on the end of the divan. It smelled like dust, and the smell was oddly comforting, reminding her of used bookstores, of browsing the racks and finding old mysteries with funny covers. She let out her breath in a rush and tipped her head back,
looking up at the chandelier painted a messy red and black, the original brass showing through in patches. It hit her suddenly that they'd made it. They were inside Cold Town. They were still human, and they even had a place to sleep. Zara got up from the couch.
You must all be starving. We don't have much food, but let me bring out what we do have. Grab some booze while you're out there, Rufus said. Grab it yourself, she told him and stalked off.
He laughed, calling something after her that Tana didn't quite catch. Tana smiled up at the chandelier, listening to them banter. She imagined herself lying on her bed in her own bedroom, with strings of fairy lights hanging above her and kitschy stenciled overpaintings from Goodwill on the wall. She thought about Pearl in the other room, watching terrible television with the volume turned up too high. Her dad would come home and then they would have dinner together. It made her feel very strange to imagine herself back there, comfortable and claustrophobic at once, as though she'd grown larger when everything else had stayed small. Her father had warned her to leave Pearl alone, but she had to say some kind of goodbye. After a moment, she went to the window and took a photo of the view of the walls from the inside in the early morning light. Then she composed a text to go with it. Cold Town is crappy, and I love you, and I'm fine. Hopefully Pearl would like that. Hopefully Pearl would understand. A few minutes later, Zara came back with a big silver tray, piled with a fairly random assortment of things. Black olives, mandarin orange slices, pickled beets, baby corn, smoked oysters still in the tin, a block of misshapen cheese, and a hunk of stale and slightly burned bread. Tana popped 3 olives into her mouth, along with a stalk of vinegary baby corn. Rufus got out a bunch of little glasses from a cabinet and a bottle of yellowish and slightly cloudy liquid. He poured with his back to them and then brought the shots over to everyone, like a butler. She thought abruptly of the drinking game she and Aiden had played at the farmhouse, the lady or the tiger. She didn't remember who'd come up with it, only that their friends had been playing it since freshman year of high school, after they'd read the story in English class. What she did recall was Pauline standing unsteadily on the granite island in Rachel Meltzer's house, red solo cup in hand, declaiming a limerick of unknown provenance. There was a young lady of Niger, who smiled as she rode on a tiger. They returned from a ride with the lady inside and the smile on the face of the tiger. What is it? Aiden asked, holding his glass up to the light and frowning at it.
You know how in prison they make pruno? Said Zara. Well, this is our Cold Town specialty, our very own moonshine. Regular old white sugar, baker's yeast, and water. We run it through a still, bottle it, and sell it.
Tana sniffed hers. It seared her nose hairs. Tiger, she chose silently and drank. Immediately she began to cough. Aiden raised his eyebrows.
What's it supposed to taste like?
Satan's balls, Rufus said, and they all laughed. He raised his glass.
To bravery, because you've got to be brave to drink this.
Christabel and Zara threw theirs back, then Aiden, then Midnight and Winter. They all winced, and Zara howled with laughter.
Burns all the way down, Rufus said. And keeps burning, Aiden put in,
but he was smiling. For a moment, Tana felt lightheaded. A cold shudder went through her body, and she was reminded of the infection lurking in her blood. I have the opposite of a fever, she thought. And shook it off. The food was weird, but it was food. She stuffed herself with it, gnawing on the bread and spreading mandarin slices over it as if they were jam. The shots got easier to knock back, too, although the more she drank, the dizzier she felt. After the third, she forced herself to stand.
I think maybe I better lie down. I don't feel so good. Well, on that note, said Rufus, a smile stretching his mouth. Let's show everyone to their rooms.
Christabel and Zara stood too, glancing covertly toward Aiden. In that moment, Tana knew something was definitely wrong. What she saw passing between them was more than laughing behind someone's back. It was scheming.
Come with me,
Christabel told Aiden, her silky gown skimming over her body as she walked toward the stairs. He started after her when Tana grabbed his hand.
Wait,
she said, her mouth feeling numb enough that she wasn't sure she could get the words out.
Wait.
He looked back at her, confused and very drunk. But once she had his attention, she couldn't think of a single thing to say that would prove something bad was about to happen.
Maybe we shouldn't bother them. I mean, they said we could just break in anywhere, right?
We can go find our own place. Aiden frowned, looking at Christabel and then back at Tana, as though he was trying to puzzle out her meaning.
I don't want to go anywhere. I feel weird,
he said, and she realized why it was so hard to think. They'd been drugged. Tana watched helplessly as he climbed the stairs, Christabel in the lead and Zara following, pushing him along. She didn't know how to save Aiden. She turned toward the open door, toward escape and the cool morning air that might clear her head. She took two faltering steps. Rufus kicked the door shut.
Going somewhere? He asked.
Midnight started to laugh from the couch.
Your face, she said. Oh my God, Tana, I wish you could see your face. I should have recorded it.
Don't be scared. I mean, really, you'd think after traveling with a vampire, you wouldn't let us rattle you. Stupid, Tana thought. I am so stupid. I got tired and distracted and sad. I stopped paying attention.
What are you going to do to us?
She's infected too, you know, Winter said. We should put them in together.
Really?
Rufus looked over at Midnight for confirmation. Her? She stretched out her skinny jean-covered legs on the couch. Her velvet top slipped to one side, showing the bandage.
I guess we'll see.
Come upstairs, Christabel called to Tana. With Rufus and Winter leading her, she had no choice. The windowless bedroom contained a mattress and a few blankets piled haphazardly on it, a brass chandelier, a scratched old skylight with water damage at the corners showed a small patch of blue sky and a lot of brown leaves. The door was big and old, with an electronic cat hatch in it. Now, when it was too late, she had a moment of terrible clarity. Two infected people. Eventually we snap and attack each other, taste human blood. Then we're not human anymore. Then we'll be willing to bite them, of course. That's what they want. She heard locks turn, one after the next. On the other side, someone started giggling. 30 brass locks with 30 brass keys, like in her dream. Fury pierced her then. She punched the door, kicked it, threw her whole body against it. But she was weak, and everything was getting cloudy.
I'm going to kill you,
she yelled through the opening, her voice coming out slow and strange.
Open this door so I can kill you.
Aiden tried to rise and collapsed heavily onto the mattress, chuckling, obviously not understanding half of what was going on.
You never give up, do you?
With her last bit of strength, she crawled onto the mattress, which smelled like cigarettes and old perfume. Curling up next to Aiden, with daylight streaming down from above, she passed out before she could answer him. Chapter 20. Death gives us sleep, eternal youth, and immortality. John Paul Richter. The Monday morning after Tana went missing, Pearl woke up early. Her father was at the kitchen table, head pillowed on his hands, sleeping in the same clothes he'd worn the night before. A half-finished coffee rested next to him, A filmy ring formed around the inside of the mug. Most days on summer vacation,